It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I believe from a sustainability standpoint, you have to be willing to use the whole animal, and we set out to set that example.
Chef Seth Elger is using an off-cut, shall we say, in his corned beef recipe. Corned beef goes with a black-eyed pea salad from Daniel Orr, two recipes to ring in the new year just right. And maybe you'll be toasting with a glass of champagne. Brad Dunn gives us the history of bubbly later on. And we take a look at how Monsanto's fantasy farming competition is playing out in Illinois high schools. One last news update with Mark Chilla before we flip the page to 2017.
Annie, our blogger Chad Bouchard took a look at laws that might be in danger. Policy watchers are especially concerned that existing legislation that promotes sustainability, nutrition, and food safety is likely to be gutted or undone under President-elect Donald Trump's administration. Many are looking ahead to the new Farm Bill, which will be up for consideration in 2018. One likely outcome of Republicans controlling all three branches of government is the severing of food assistance from the Farm Bill. Attempts to do so under the previous administration failed, but Trump has stated he supports splitting the bill. In 2013, the U.S. House approved a farm bill without the nutrition program, but that version did not go through the Senate. The USDA issued new rules earlier this month that blasted the poultry industry for treating farmers unfairly and pitted them against each other. While farmers own their growing facilities, they must upgrade them according to companies' standards at their own expense. But the companies also control prices of chicks and feed, which pinches profit margins. New grain inspection, packers, and stockyards administration rules would make it easier for farmers to challenge unfair practices. But the new rules don't go into effect until after a 60-day comment period, which ends under a new presidency. The National Pork Producers Council has vowed to pressure the incoming Trump administration to kill the rules. And food labeling requirements could also be on the chopping block. The president-elect took aim at the 2010 Affordable Care Act during his campaign, which includes label requirements. There has been scant details about what would replace the ACA, but business opposition to more label requirements could meet less resistance under the new administration. Trump named Georgia Representative Tom Price as his pick to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Price voted for a bill to ban states like Vermont from labeling genetically modified ingredients. Price's voting record on food issues includes voting against the Food Safety Modernization Act that was meant to crack down on outbreaks of foodborne illness, opposing the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act to improve school meal nutrition, and co-sponsoring a bill that would allow convenience and grocery stores to opt out of menu labeling requirements. We've got reporters like Chad keeping their eyes on these stories. Updates are at eartheats.org, where you can also check out food writer Mimi Sheridan's predictions on what we'll see on our plates in 2017.
We do the Twitter thing at EarthEats. Hope to see you over there. Our newsman is Mark Chilla. Thank you.
Over and out, Annie.
You'll find plenty of fresh produce at the grocery store this time of year. Carrots from California or peppers from Mexico. Thanks to a geothermal greenhouse, maybe Nebraskans could start buying local citrus. An encore presentation of this story from Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media.
I'm at a local grocery co-op in Lincoln, Nebraska called Open Harvest. They sell a lot of locally grown fruits and vegetables here, at least during the spring and summer and fall they do. But it's the middle of winter now, and this is when the local food supply starts to freeze up.
We can get kale and some culinary herbs this time of year.
Nicole Seville is the produce manager at Open Harvest.
Otherwise, the only other local option is a soil mix in our garden center.
Which means the carrots and onions and pears and radishes on the shelf right now made a long trip to get here.
This time of year, we are sourcing globally almost. It hurts me to say because, you know, the fossil fuels that it takes to get things here is astronomical. But we try to source from within the United States whenever we can. Florida and California are going to be the two biggest options.
So this time of year, you might be able to get kale from Nebraska. What about oranges?
No, I wish, though. I sure do wish.
Well, I recently met someone who would like to grant that wish.
We can grow the best citrus in the world right here on the High Plains.
This is Russ Finch. We're in his greenhouse near Alliance in western Nebraska. He calls it the greenhouse in the snow. Finch built and designed it himself. It's like a citrus grove inside, with lemons the size of oranges and oranges the size of grapefruits in Nebraska.
This is a Valencia orange that's the standard juice orange.
But the other unique thing about the greenhouse is it's geothermal. It harnesses the Earth's heat. All the heating and cooling comes from pumping air through underground tubes.
All we try to do is keep it above 28 degrees in the winter. And we have no backup system for heat. The only heat source is Earth's heat at 52 degrees at 8 foot deep.
The idea behind Finch's design is that you can grow a variety of crops year-round in a low-energy, low-carbon system. If that were to work on a large scale, Nebraska stores could sell local lettuce in the dead of winter, maybe even local oranges.
I think it's a fascinating idea.
Stacy Adams teaches horticulture and greenhouse management at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says there are different designs for low-energy greenhouses. Some move air or water underground. Some store solar heat in water tanks. He says a lot of people are testing sustainable ways to get through cold winter nights.
We could use fossil fuels, but if we can make the environment better by using the sustainable options, why not do it? It's basically free energy that we could capture.
Energy is one of the biggest costs for Midwestern greenhouses. Adams says geothermal greenhouses can work, but there are limitations to such a low energy system. For instance, it's good for cold crops like kale, cabbage, lettuce.
But when we start getting into the warm-loving crops like tomatoes, which everybody loves, and cucumbers and squash, then we're talking about greenhouses that need to be much warmer.
It's actually easier to grow oranges in a cold greenhouse than tomatoes, Adams says. Also, low-energy greenhouses are most efficient when they're small, meaning they might supply a farmer's market, but probably not a supermarket. To grow more, you'll need more energy, perhaps fossil fuels. Don Thilmany studies local food at Colorado State University. She says growing in local greenhouses isn't always best for energy consumption.
It might actually, energy-wise, make more sense to ship from faraway distances because we do have a lot of energy-efficient ways to ship, including trains, barges, and such.
But ideas like greenhouse in the snow could change that equation.
In the case where people are being innovative, where some of that energy is an alternative form, it might make a lot of sense to produce locally year-round.
That could give winter a local flavor, even in the Midwest. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
We first aired this story last February. Watch a video that goes with it at harvestpublicmedia.org. Traditional New Year's dishes are about encouraging good fortune. Well, at least that's the superstition that comes with corned beef, cabbage, and black-eyed peas. But we're upending those traditional recipes today. Corned beef is usually made with brisket or beef round, but Chef Seth Elger has a different cut in the brine.
So we have a fresh local cow tongue in corning spice. So it's pickling so that we can go on to make corned beef.
Elger is the executive chef and general manager at No Coast.
Corning uses pickling spices, so we're talking peppercorns, mustard seed, clove, allspice berries, bay leaves. It's got a lot of garlic, some ginger in there as well. So these very, very strong flavors help overcome some of those strong associations people have with a muscle cut like tongue.
He soaked them in salt water for a couple hours before submerging them in the brine. They'll be in here for about 5 days. Then Elger will cook the tongue in a fresh batch of brine before making the terrine. The finished product will be similar to a pâté, but held together with gelatin.
So with this particular preparation, what we're doing is taking our terrine mold here and lining it with blanched Savoy cabbage leaves, and then filling it with a smoked turkey aspic. Aspic is a homemade stock that's been set with gelatin to be thicker so that it holds together. And we'll float in purple potatoes, a little bit of onion, some herbs, and then put the finished corned beef through the center.
Is this cheaper?
Actually, to get good quality tongue, you're going to pay as much as what you would for something like Eye of Round. So it's really just, if you want that particular cut, you're going to pay the same high $2, low $3 per pound.
Are people going to be turned off by tongue?
We've run tongue several times here, including in our homemade head cheese. We also have run a smoked tongue special as well. And we get away with quite a bit of the offal, as it were. I believe from a sustainability standpoint, you have to be willing to use the whole animal. And we set out to set that example.
A playful take on corned beef with Chef Seth Elger. He runs No Coast. That's a great message there from Seth, using the whole animal if you're a meat eater. It can be intimidating, though, without a doubt. So check out some beginner recipes we've posted that use tongue, heart, and liver. Now, with Daniel Orr, how do you make black-eyed peas? Probably not in a way that you'd call healthy.
So instead of doing a traditional kind of bacon, heavy kind of black-eyed pea dish, we're going to do a very light dish that, if your New Year's resolution is to eat healthy and eat fresh, this would be a great way to start the new year. All right, so basically we're going to make a little dressing by mixing some olive oil and lemon juice. Okay, and then we're going to add the other components to the salad. We've got some black olives, some nice diced red pepper. And what you want to do is to make the food exciting and colorful. Okay, we're going to add some mint, but you could use any other types of herbs you wanted. I'm also going to toss in the black-eyed peas. And to give it a real crisp freshness, we're going to add some cucumbers. And I've peeled and diced these and taken the seeds out. And we're going to toss all this together. And you have the black olives. We're also going to add some feta cheese to this. So you have some salty components. And so you want to be very careful when you season this not to add too much salt. Again, salt is one of those things, once you add it, you can't take it out. So always under-season, and then you can add more if you need it. Okay, to finish off, we're going to add a little bit of toasted walnuts. Again, with the nuts, we've toasted them to bring out their essential oils and give them a little extra flavor. I'm going to add a nice pinch of garlic and just a handful of whatever your favorite herbs are. We use some parsley, some cilantro, and a little bit of scallion. You know, one bite here, you're going to get a little bit of that mint and some feta. Another bite, you're going to get a black olive and some walnuts. And so it tastes different all through the eating of the dish. And so that's a good way to kind of create dishes, is to think that, you know, you don't want every bite to taste exactly the same. So don't finally mince everything. Leave it rustic and fun and playful. Okay, and today I'm going to serve it just over a bed of baby arugula. Okay, and that's all there is to it. It's a wonderful way to start your new year with something light, healthy, and tasty.
And colorful. This recipe and a gorgeous picture at eartheats.org. Ahead, can't do a show on New Year's without talking about champagne. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Good day to you. This is Earth Eats. Millions of people play fantasy football each season. The game puts them in complete control of their favorite NFL players. With the click of a mouse or the swipe of a phone, they decide who gets to play and who sits on the bench. Fantasy farming, on the other hand, is not quite as popular, and it's more about education than wins and losses. For Harvest Public Media, Rich Egger reports.
I'm on a tram with students from an agriculture class at Mercer County High School. A red Dodge pickup truck pulls the tram, navigating the paved and gravel roads running through a research facility run by the agriculture giant Monsanto just south of Monmouth, Illinois. The roads have names such as Breeding Boulevard, Roundup Road, and Monsanto Mile. We pull up to a plot of field corn rustling in the wind on one of those autumn days when it still feels warm in the sun but chilly in the shade.
You guys can come on up here closer if you want.
The plot is roughly 100 feet by 20 feet.
All right, so this is your plot.
This is Troy Kazire. He's manager of the Learning Center.
This particular plot has had corn 3 years in a row now. So that's really a pretty important piece of information when you're making decisions on what you're going to do. What might that, how might that change some of your decisions? Yeah.
Not much nutrients in the soil as it would if you had beans or something.
Okay, so in particular, corn uses a lot of nitrogen, right?
This is one of 17 plots in this section of the research center. Each plot is used by a different high school from the region as they compete against each other in fantasy farming. Kazire says each school chooses a kind of corn seed hybrid. Monsanto gives them 10 options from their own stock. He says the students then make numerous other decisions, such as when to plant, how much nitrogen to use, whether to apply a fungicide. The goal is to grow the most corn on your school's plot.
It's almost like picking a fantasy football team, right? They're drafting their team and you know the hybrid is like the quarterback, right? That's kind of that's the first choice you're gonna make. Nitrogen is kind of like the running back. That's carrying the load.
The schools give their instructions to Kazire early in the calendar year. Monsanto workers tend to the plots, following each school's wishes through the spring and summer. Then, in the fall, the students are bussed out to the farm to see how well their decisions fared. As part of these field trips, four students wade into the sea of corn in their school's plot.
If you get lost, follow the road.
They disappear into the center, then re-emerge after each has picked what they consider an average-size ear of corn from the plot. These are used to help estimate the yield, although the school's exact yield won't be known until the plots are harvested. One of the students sent into the plot is senior Nicholas Close.
The corn looked pretty clean, disease-wise. The ears look decent. Looks like it'll do good for us.
Close grows corn and soybeans for his FFA project, and he hopes to one day manage his family's farm. Close says it was cool to experiment with the crop as part of the fantasy farming contest.
Well, when the output might not be there because of the lower prices, we've learned to cut back some. Sometimes that's a good method to do, and that's what we tried this year. We tried 20-inch rows this year, which we think's a good practice to try.
This is the fourth year of Monsanto's fantasy farming competition. The company also runs competitions near Huxley, Iowa, and Gothenburg, Nebraska. Mercer County ag teacher Michael Chaussey says his school participates each year. He thinks it helps students develop an appreciation of the challenges farmers face.
What they have to think about and the potential of things going really well and things not working out so well. It's a lot of guesswork and it's a gamble.
Good luck, guys.
The students leave not knowing how well their gambles paid off. They'll find out after all the schools get a chance to visit their plots and all the corn is harvested. And just like in many fantasy football leagues, the teams are playing for more than just pride. Monsanto pays $1,000 to the school that produces the highest yield, and another $1,000 goes to the school that turns the largest profit. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rich Egger.
We've had a blast sharing drink recipes all month on the show. We've talked about coffee and kombucha and cocktails and eggnog. For the final show this year, let's pop a bottle of bubbly. Brad Dunn is here to talk about champagne. He's the beverage director at the Uptown Cafe in Bloomington. He's got the restaurant stocked and ready for the big night.
We bought a humongous bottle of champagne.
How big is humongous? From the floor to your hand?
Pretty damn big.
How many glasses?
A Methuselah. It's like 50 or 60 glasses.
For New Year's, most of us won't be buying champagne in quite that volume. He says a good rule of thumb is 6 to 7 glasses from one bottle of wine. He came into the Earth Eats studios in 2012 to talk about the history of champagne and to give some suggestions for broadening the appeal of bubbly from just a celebratory drink to something you'd serve with a nice dinner. But first, it can seem like the word champagne is a generic term for bubbly white wine, but it's not. It's much more complicated than that.
The producers of champagne have been very, very careful and very, very smart to designate the word champagne to mean only the sparkling wine of that very, very small region to the east of Paris. Champagne actually exists at the northernmost extreme of viticulture, which means that it didn't grow very good grapes. So actually, it was highly acidic and very thin. They really have trouble ripening the grapes that far north. There was actually a big rivalry with Burgundy to the south. Burgundy was producing this beautiful Pinot Noir, and Champagne was producing this thin, acidic, disgusting, nasty.
Well, they fixed it in the meantime.
They did. Actually, bubbles were initially considered a flaw. What happens is, if you know a little about science, yeast, you use yeast to make bread, and bread rises. Same thing happens in producing wine. Yeast produces alcohol, but also produces CO2. What would happen, think about the annual cycle of harvesting grapes. Grapes are harvested in the late summer, early fall, and then you throw some yeast on there, use natural yeast, and it starts fermenting, and it starts bubbling, and then it stops. Well, why does it stop? Well, one of the reasons, winter approaches. So the fermentation stops, yeast go to sleep. But what happens in the spring, and if you have a good imagination like I do, it's actually really funny. What would happen is in the cellars, can you imagine monks being frightened, woken up as, the warming of spring, yeast woke up, they started fermenting again, and all these bottles were exploding in the cellars of these abbeys. And this actually also happened as the Champagne wine, other people were shipping wine to warmer climates. They would ship them in barrels, and then they would, yeast would wake up going from a colder climate to a warmer climate, and so the wine would become fizzy. So it was initially considered a really horrible flaw until it was documented by an English scientist, physician, I think his name Christopher Merritt. Anyway, so he wrote a paper documenting the purposeful fermentation to create bubbles in wine.
The English?
The English.
Champagne is in France?
Yeah, it's funny. The French were actually very stubborn. It was actually in the mid-1600s that Merritt documented this process, and the French, didn't actually adopt it until the early to mid-1800s. So it took them... Took them almost 200 years to say, well, I guess this is better, we'll do that. And coincidentally, I said the glass was so fragile, the bottles were exploding in the cellars. In the mid-1600s, the English industrial glassmakers actually came up with the formula for a much stronger version of glass. So it was coincidentally sort of a simultaneous convergence of invention.
Cool, our wine history lesson today. What grapes is champagne?
Champagne is made from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and another grape that is pretty obscure called Pinot Meunier. So a Blanc de Blanc is made from 100% Chardonnay. A Blanc de Noir, white from black, is a white wine made from Pinot Noir. For a lot of champagne connoisseurs, a rosé champagne, where they purposefully allow some of the skins to sort of hang out with the juice a little bit, you get that nice pinkish color. And some, rosé champagnes have a really beautiful aroma and flavor. Now, as it happens, bubbles or champagne or any type of sparkling wine really is one of the best food pairs.
I was going to ask that because I've never had a glass of champagne with dinner.
I know.
Ever.
I don't understand how Americans, as fond as we are of soda pop, that it hasn't caught on that, to drink sparkling wine with food.
So can you give me an idea of what would be great with a really nice high-end bottle of champagne? Like, make a meal for
popcorn.
Me. What? Popcorn and champagne?
Yes, your next date night where you're renting movies at home, snuggle up with your honey bunny and grab some bubbles and some popcorn. But a serious food pair, definitely sushi, any type of light meat or fish or cream sauce, anything that you would pair like a nice white wine with, a nice crisp white, I'd try some bubbles.
So let's give people advice for the upcoming new year.
Yes.
What's a great, tasty, but affordable bottle of champagne that you're not going to maybe wake up with the worst hangover of your life
on
the first?
I can't guarantee that. I try to shy away from specific recommendations, but I would look to cava. Cava is Spain's answer to champagne or champagne, and I can't call it that anymore. They have to call it cava.
Which is just sparkling white wine.
Sparkling wine from a specific region, northeast Spain. They grow it other places, but most of it is from sort of that northeast region. Can be very affordable. They're one of the most affordable sparkling wines out there. Also look to Italy. Prosecco is wonderful, made from the Prosecco grape in northeastern Italy, the Prosecco region. And American sparkling wine is great. There's a lot of really good stuff out there coming from Cali.
Really?
Northern Cali, yeah. And, you know, for $30, $40, a nice champagne, if you bring it, you know, to your New Year's party, you will be beloved by your friends.
Perfect. Is there anything else you want to add?
Happy New Year, everybody.
Brad Dunn is the beverage director at the Uptown Cafe. He talks about bourbon and scotch and tips for finding yourself a cheap but delicious bottle of wine at eartheats.org. We're doing a little celebrating at Earth Eats because this is our 400th show. That is so amazing to say, 400 episodes. So our thanks this week to Adam Schweigert, who came up with the idea for Earth Eats 7 years ago. Chef Daniel Orr was also there from the very beginning. Thanks to WFIU Bloomington and executive producer John Bailey for believing in a show about local food. And then to all the producers, reporters, bloggers, and chefs who have made appearances on Earth Eats, a heartfelt thank you for making our program what it is. Big things ahead for us in 2017, including the release of our cookbook in the spring. Keep close to eartheats.org for news, recipes, interviews, and so much more.
Should old acquaintance be forgotten, never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days old lang syne?
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Of course, thanks to you for listening and supporting Earth Eats. See you on the flip side. I'm Annie Corrigan.
The cup of kindness yet for